to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, what in the world is going on? An intelligence briefing for Alaskan leaders with Herb Meyer, former senior intelligence official for President Reagan. During the Reagan administration, Mr. Meyer served as a special assistant to the Director of Central Intelligence, Bill Casey, and he was also vice chairman of the CIA's National Intelligence Council. In these positions, he produced national intelligence estimates and other top secret publications for the president and President Reagan's team of national security advisors. Mr. Meyer is widely credited with being the first senior U.S. government official to predict the collapse of the Soviet Union. For this forecast, he was later awarded the U.S. National Intelligence Distinguished Service Medal, which is the intelligence community's highest honor. Formerly an associate editor of Fortune, Mr. Meyer has authored several books, including The War Against Progress, Real World Intelligence, and Hard Thinking. He and his wife Jill are co-authors of How to Write, which is among the world's most widely used writing handbooks. He's written essays on intelligence and politics that have been published in the Wall Street Journal, the National Review Online, Policy Review, and The American Thinker. Mr. Meyer is also the host and producer of The Siege of Western Civilization, a DVD outlining the threats to our security, our economy, and our culture that has become an international bestseller. His latest project, which is available online, is called How to Analyze Information, a step-by-step guide to life's most vital skill. His talk, entitled What in the World is Going On? An Intelligence Briefing for Alaskan Leaders, was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on Friday, May 1st, 2009. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents former senior intelligence official for President Reagan, Herb Meyer.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I haven't been here in Anchorage in about 30 years. And yesterday afternoon, after I checked in, I just took some time to walk around and take a look at the city. Boy, it's changed a lot. Wouldn't have recognized it. On the other hand, I've changed a lot, which may explain why nobody recognized me. Anyway, I'm very happy to be back here with you today. I want to talk to you about some of the big things going on in the world. And then we'll loop back over these subjects and talk about where they're going and what it's going to mean to us. One point before we begin. I've been messing around with this stuff for a long time. In the last few years, a trend has developed in our country that's unhealthy. We argue before we understand. Not a good thing to do. Sets a terrible example for our kids. When there are complicated and contentious issues, honorable people will disagree about what to do. That's fine. That's how we find our way forward. Intelligent people should be able to reach a common understanding of what the problem is before we start arguing about it. And we've lost that ability. Look at any of our election campaigns. Watch the talk shows, even when I'm one of the talking heads. It's a shouting match. Let's not do that this afternoon. I've left my politics at home today. I hope you have too. If you want to know what I think we should do, buy me a beer some evening. I will be happy to tell you in great detail. Let's leave all the partisan stuff out of this. If we can reach an understanding of what's happening out there and what it means to us, we'll have come a long way forward. When you look at the world, the first thing you find yourself looking at, of course, is the war. And of all the issues, this is the most contentious. Some people think President Bush did a marvelous job. Other people think he made a god-awful mess of it. That's another conversation for another place. What's important is to understand what this war is about, because that may give us an understanding of where it is right now, and more importantly, where it's going, what's likely to happen next. To understand what the war is about, press the rewind button. Go all the way back into history. When you do that, you'll see that history is the story of competing operating systems. Now, if there's one thing we all understand, it's competing operating systems. When operating systems collide in the marketplace, things get very nasty very quickly, technically and legally. The technical people work out patches and fixes. The legal people work out cross-licensing agreements. Consumers sort through what they like and what they don't like. Life goes on. Microsoft has a lot of money. It hasn't got tanks. If Bill Gates had tanks, Apple's corporate headquarters would look like a building in downtown Beirut. In politics, there really are tanks. And when one operating system sets out to impose itself on another operating system, that's war. That's the definition of a war. Our operating system is Western civilization. That's who we are. It started with the Greeks, but it took off in Europe in the 15th and 16th centuries when Judaism and Christianity reconciled with the modern world. The rabbis, the priests, the scholars, they figured it out. They paved the way forward. That triggered the scientific revolution itself. It ignited the greatest explosion of art, literature, and music the world's ever known. Shakespeare, Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Bach. When you stand back from it, here's what Western civilization is. The individual is at the center of it. Church and state are separate. It's the rule of law, the idea of property rights, economic liberty, individual rights, human rights, women's rights. In Western civilization, we unleash the entrepreneurial talents of our people. We encourage intellectual curiosity. It's an endless struggle for equality among the races and the sexes. Is Western civilization perfect? No, couldn't be. It's designed and operated by human beings. But when all is said and done, Western civilization is history's most extraordinary accomplishment. It's the modern world. In just the last century, there have been two efforts by other operating systems to knock us off. The first was fascism, World War II. If Hitler and the Nazis, Mussolini, the Japanese warlords, if they had been content to impose that miserable operating system only on their own people, too bad, but wouldn't have had World War II. It's only when they come after you. It happened a second time in the Cold War, and that was the Kremlin's effort to impose the Soviet communist operating system on everybody else. Stand back from history. There's one more operating system that's been out there a long time, and that's Islam. The reason you can describe Islam as an operating system is that in Islam, church and state are combined. They don't have that separation. Islam is a political structure as well as a faith. The individual is subservient to the church-state combination. Islam does not unleash the entrepreneurial talents of its people. It discourages intellectual curiosity. By the way, this is one of the great tragedies of history. The Muslims are geniuses. Algebra is an Arabic word. They virtually invented the science of medicine. In every field of science and technology, they were the world's leaders, and then everything stopped. There's no other example in history of that happening. If you spend 1,000 years crushing intellectual curiosity, literally destroying your geniuses, you won't get new technology, you won't get new science. The great tragedy is we have no way of knowing what the human race would have known if they hadn't done that. There's one other feature of that operating system that's relevant. It treats women as though they were property rather than people. And very simply put, that operating system is incompatible with the modern world. And that's the glitch. This is what the Pope was talking about when he gave that famous speech in Regensburg. Remember the one he gave a couple of years ago that just exploded across the world? What the Pope was saying is this. When you look at the history of Western civilization, it's obvious we've made horrific mistakes. But over the centuries, we've learned to temper faith with reason. We've found our way forward. What you're telling us, he said to the Muslim world in that speech, is that the Quran is the unalterable word of God. Now, the Quran's a marvelous book. There are passages in the Quran, every bit as moving and every bit as beautiful as anything in the Old Testament or the New Testament. But there are passages in the Quran, they're called surahs, S-U-R-A. There are surahs in the Quran that say very clearly, very unambiguously, convert the infidel or kill him. And what the Pope was asking, and he talked in that circumlocutious way that popes talk, is, do we have a problem? If that's unalterable and it says, kill us, how do we live together? Boy, did he ask the right question. He went to the heart of the issue in a way that no political leader had the brains or the guts to do. That's why that speech exploded across the world. Now, human nature doesn't change. Anywhere you go, the overwhelming majority of people are perfectly moderate, decent people. They're doing their jobs, they're raising their kids, they don't want to cause any trouble for anybody. Most Germans weren't Nazis. In the Cold War years, most Russians weren't communists. The overwhelming majority of Muslim people are absolutely marvelous, wonderful people. They're raising their kids, they're going about their business. Be lucky to have them as your neighbors. But when the radicals are in charge, Islam attacks the West. That's what happened in the 7th century. Islam attacked the West, took over Spain, France, North Africa. Anybody happen to see the movie El Cid with Charlton Heston? Deals with that. I got to know Charlton Heston. He was one of President Reagan's friends, and the president liked to invite his Hollywood buddies to visit him at the White House. They'd sit around, they'd have a couple of drinks, they'd swap stories. That's how the president liked to relax. And Reagan being Reagan, he used to say the bad news is that there were so few conservatives in Hollywood. The good news is one out of three got to be president. And he was the one. Heston was one of the two losers. We actually needed something done at the CIA, and for complicated reasons, only Charlton Heston could do it. We asked him. He did it for us. Very quietly, very competently, very nice man. Anyway, Islam hit the West in the 7th century. Islam attacked a second time in the 16th and 17th centuries. By 1683, they had reached the gates of Vienna. And it was right outside Vienna in 1683 that the climactic battle took place between Islam and the West. The West won. We've been going forward ever since. Islam lost. Do any of you happen to know the date of the battle outside Vienna in 1683 between Islam and the West? September 11. Isn't that interesting? Next time one of the kids or grandkids comes home from school and says, "History's boring. Why do I have to study it?" That's why. On September 10, 2001, there wasn't one member of the Bush administration who had a clue that the next day was an important day in the history of Islam, and they should have known it. It's what we pay them for. By the way, that battle is one of history's turning points. It's virtually disappeared from the history books. It's rarely talked about. It's rarely taught. It's interesting. The battle is so important, echoes of the battle come down to us every day, even in this hotel. After the battle ended, there were celebrations all through the West to mark the victory over Islam. As part of these celebrations, Viennese bakers invented a new kind of roll. They baked it in the shape of a crescent. Crescent is the symbol of Islam. Eating these crescents became a very popular thing to do. The French word for crescent is croissant. I had a couple of them for breakfast this morning. History's fascinating. We should teach it. What we're seeing today, what we call the war on terrorism, or now overseas contingency operations, is actually the third attack on Western civilization by radical Islam. Terrorism's a tactic. And the lesson of 9/11 is this. We live in a world in which a small number of people can kill a large number of people very quickly. That's what's new. That's what's different. They can hijack airplanes, fly them into buildings. If they pour botulism into the Anchorage water supply, you'll kill 40,000 people overnight. What do you do? Remember this. If you play defense, you're going to lose. When you play defense, you have to win 100% of the time. And you can't. Nobody's that good. If we had a great intelligence service, I don't think we do, but let's say it was as good as it could possibly be. Let's say it could stop 25 out of 26 terrorist attacks. That's very good, except you're dead. 26th attack, gotcha. When you play defense, you're going to lose. So what do you do? And no one's crazy enough to say, well, let's just nuke everybody. And this was the dilemma that President Bush faced after 9/11. If you play defense, you're going to get hit. And no one's crazy enough to say, let's nuke everybody. What the president set out to do was this, not to impose our operating system on them. What we wanted was for Islam to do what Judaism and Christianity had done centuries ago, reconcile with the modern world, join us in the 21st century, in effect, develop version 2.0. If they could do that, the level of violence would drop. Everyone would be a lot safer. That was the objective. The strategy for accomplishing the objective was to use our military power to knock out the radicals and give the moderates a chance to hold power. In some cases, the first chance in years, in other cases, decades, in some cases, centuries. Remember, the moderates are the overwhelming majority because the moderates are always the overwhelming majority. If they could get a grip on power and hold it, everyone would be a lot safer. Now, when you look back over the last few years, all the yelling and screaming about Iraq was over our execution of that strategy. And fair enough, I don't know anyone who thinks it was perfect. What happened, and this was the political catastrophe, is that when things began to go wrong, everybody lost track of what the objective was. You know, first rule of life, whether you're running a business or a country or any other organization, no plan survives its collision with reality. The world doesn't work that way. There's usually something you should have anticipated but didn't. There's very often something you could not possibly have anticipated. And we're not all geniuses. We make mistakes. The only thing you can predict with absolute certainty is when you try and execute a complicated plan, it's going to go off course. And when you're struggling to get your plan back on course, boy, you better remember where you were going. And it's crucial that the people you work with, whether they're your colleagues in a business or whether they're voters in a democracy, understand what you're trying to do. Because then they can measure whether you're still drifting off course or whether you've started to make the course corrections. And that's what went haywire with this war. Everybody started yelling and screaming. It went off course. And everyone lost track of what we were trying to do. Now, I'll come back in a few minutes to where the war is right now and what's likely to happen next. But for the moment, keep one thing in mind. When you look at the war, when you talk about the war, argue about the war, what you're looking at is an effort to shift 1.5 billion people from the 8th century into the 21st century fast. Anybody who thought you could do that easily and without making mistakes is living in a dream world. While that's going on over there, there's a transformation taking place in our part of the world whose impact on our country, on our economy, and on your businesses will be much greater. Our part of the world is Western civilization, the modern world. What's happening today is something no one had anticipated. We've stopped breeding, literally. Here are the numbers. If you want to keep a steady population in a country, the birth rate has to be 2.1, 2.1 births per woman. You need the two births to replace the mother and father. Then you need 0.1. Some children don't live, don't grow up and have their own children. So 2.1 is the crucial number. Today in Western Europe, the birth rate's 1.5. It's 30% below replacement. What that means in real numbers is that 30 years from now, there will be between 70 and 80 million fewer Europeans alive than are alive today. That's the biggest, fastest population drop in recorded history. The birth rate in Germany is 1.3. Ask a German teenager, how many cousins have you got? The kid says, what's a cousin? If you have one child and the child grows up and marries someone who's also an only child, and then they have one child, which is what's happening, there's no aunt, there's no uncle, there's no cousin. In Germany today, 30% of all women are childless. Among college-educated German women, 40% are childless. That's shutdown. It means the actual population is plunging. That means empty buildings, empty apartments, empty condos, empty houses. The two countries in Western Europe with the lowest birth rates are Italy and Spain, 1.2 trending down to 1.1. With a 1.2 birth rate, in 20 years, you lose 30% of your working age population. Take 30% of the working age population out of Anchorage. Where's the economy? Who's in the schools? Who's at the malls? Where's your workforce? Who's in the restaurants? Who's buying the things we're selling? You're dead. And this is what's happening. Turns out, also to everyone's astonishment, there's a very powerful correlation between faith and kids. People of faith tend to lead traditional lives. Grow up, settle down, get married, have a family. Europe has lost its faith. Europe describes itself as a secular post-Judeo-Christian civilization. That's their phrase for it, not mine. It's a nice way of saying the churches are empty except for a few old ladies and tourists. Turns out that if your whole population thinks we're just a collection of molecules held together by gravity, there is no higher purpose, we've been activated, at some point our molecules deactivate, nobody's going to fight for anything. Might as well just make yourself comfortable. It's a lot more fun to sit at a cafe or go skiing than it is to stay up all night with a sick kid. So they stopped having kids. They also stopped getting married. Today in Europe, only 1 out of 7 couples gets married. It's pretty much gone. They don't have babies. They don't like getting married. It turns out they don't like working either. Today, the average European gets an additional 450 hours per year vacation versus an American worker. That's 10 and a half weeks. Give every American worker an additional 10 and a half weeks paid vacation, the economy drops dead. The gap with Scandinavia is now 17 weeks. Statistically, 1 out of 5 working-age Swedes is on permanent disability insurance, which is odd because they look healthy to me. There's a young woman in Stockholm, looks like she could be on the Swedish Olympic gymnastics team. She claimed to be allergic to electricity and therefore cannot be employed anywhere electric power is used. They gave her permanent disability insurance. Okay, you can't do that and survive, okay? Look, there's a basic deal in the modern world. The modern state is a welfare state. And I mean that in the best sense of the word. The modern state recognizes an obligation to its citizens, to the young, to the poor, to the disadvantaged, to the elderly. We can argue over how to do that as Republicans versus Democrats or in France as Gaullists versus Socialists, but everybody understands the modern state has an obligation to its people. Boy, is that expensive. Takes a lot of money. Where do you get money from? Taxpayers. And where do you get taxpayers from? Kids, they grow up, they become taxpayers. That's how it works. Everybody forgot to do the math. To show you how fast this deteriorates, I was talking to a young woman about this, and she was telling me she has one sister. So her parents produced 2 children to take care of 2 adults. Take care of in the sense of work, generate the tax revenue for Medicare, Social Security, the senior buses that run people around to, you know, shopping malls and movie matinees and things, everything. And to take care of them literally. Drive to the house on Saturday, have lunch with them, mow the lawn, run them over to the dentist. This young woman has a partner, not a husband, a partner. They don't plan to have children. Her sister is married, has 1 child, doesn't plan to have any more. These 4 people produced 1 child to take care of them. Do you realize the tax burden on that 1 kid? It's crushing. And by the way, those 4 are going to live longer and the cost of health care isn't dropping. And that doesn't even include the human element of spend some time with aging parents, drive them to the dentist, whatever it might be. Europe forgot to do the math. They forgot to produce the next generation. Well, if you don't produce them, but you want to keep the machine going, what do you do? The answer, of course, is you import people. Who are they importing? Muslims. Today, the Muslim population of countries like France and Germany is 10%. By the way, that 10% is correct but misleading. The Muslim population of France right now is 10%. When you look at the population of France under the age of 20, Muslims are now 30% of the total. And when you look at the population of France under the age of 20 living in cities, Muslims are now 40%. The problem is that they're not being integrated into European society. The Europeans believe deeply in multiculturalism. Now, there's a word you hear a lot, more and more in our own country, particularly if you have kids in the schools. Have you noticed no one ever defines the word? When all the intellectuals and talking heads start using a big new word, get the definition. The technical definition of multiculturalism is people of different faiths and cultures are permitted to settle without being required to integrate. And that's what's happening in Europe. They're settling but not integrating. When you travel across Europe, all the major cities, Paris, Hamburg, Rome, Marseille, Amsterdam, they're literally ringed by housing developments, villages and towns that are entirely Muslim. The police won't go there. They call them no-go zones. With all the car burnings in France, that's what you're beginning to see boil over now. To give you a sense of how separate these communities are culturally, today, the fastest rising crime on the continent of Europe is a father killing his daughter. These honor killings. 15-year-old girl comes home from school one afternoon in Rome or Paris. Father says, pack. Kid says, what are you talking about? He says, well, I just arranged a marriage for you. You're going to marry Achmed. He's got 14 acres outside of Peshawar. Kid says, forget it. I'm going to the dance on Saturday and I want to go to college, maybe do my junior year in the United States on a Rotary scholarship. Father and brother's killer. It's fastest rise in crime in Europe. About 5 years ago in Norway, the country's leading poet, 27-year-old woman, third generation, born in Oslo, but Turkish. She announced her engagement to a Norwegian oil engineer, kind of engagement you see in the style section of the Sunday papers. Her father and five brothers killed her. She was Norway's leading poet. These honor killings have spread throughout Europe. They're happening in Canada. We've had one in Atlanta and two in Dallas. Fastest rise in crime there is. To a great extent, this effort to integrate is going backwards rather than forwards. In England, the Manchester School District just noticed they're missing 3,000 girls. The enrollment of girls freshman to sophomore year dropped 3,000. They have no idea what happened. They're just not there. Whether they've been pulled out of school, sent off on marriages, or done away with, they don't know. They're just not there. Another example of how it's going backwards, also in England. You know, England has a nationalized healthcare system. It's very heavily staffed by Muslim nurses and doctors. They're very competent. They're very highly trained. About 6 months ago, the association that represents women Muslim nurses and doctors announced that from now on, they will no longer scrub before surgery. Immoral to bare their arms to their elbows. These are not immigrants who just got off the boat. These are doctors. When the most educated people in your society are checking out of the modern world, you have a problem. When President Obama was in Europe last month, trying to get the Europeans to help us out in Afghanistan and asking them to adopt economic stimulus packages, which would load the debt onto the next generation, you know, Europeans told them to get lost. There is no next generation. They got no one to load it onto. The gap between Europe and the United States is widening enormously. Same thing's happening in Japan. The birth rate in Japan is now 1.3, about the same as Germany, and dropping a little bit. What that means is 30 years from now, there will be between 50 and 60 million fewer Japanese alive than are alive today. Japan's a different place. They're not going to bring in 50 million Koreans to run it or 50 million Turks. They're shutting it down. In Japan, they've already closed 2,000 schools, K through 12. They're now closing schools in Japan at a rate of 300 school closings every year. They plan to continue closing 300 schools a year as far ahead as they can see. They've closed two universities. They're on the verge of closing a third. Now they're talking about combining prefectures, which is like their states or counties. This is shut down. What happens when your birth rate drops below that 2.1 replacement level is that your whole population's aging because you don't have enough young people to replace the older people. Japan is aging so fast that by 2020, one out of every five Japanese citizens will be over the age of 70. How you run a modern society with one out of five people over the age of 70, no one has any idea. It's never been done. Japan's finance minister gave a speech about this. What he said was, the situation is getting so bad so fast, the day is rapidly coming when every Japanese citizen at the age of 65 will be shipped permanently to the Philippines, where they have lots of young people who work cheap to take care of them, and he wasn't kidding. Here in North America, the picture's a little bit different. Our friends in Canada now have a birth rate of 1.5. In effect, Canada's become a European country in North America. Here in the United States, we're the only country in the West bucking the trend. For the last 30 years, the U.S. birth rate has been stuck at 2, just below the 2.1 replacement level. So we've been going in the same direction, but not at the same rate, much more shallow glide path. In 2008, for the first time in 30 years, we hit the 2.1. The numbers are just coming in. Demographers are looking at them, massaging the numbers. Nobody's quite sure what happened. Sometimes you get an uptick of a tenth or two-tenths or a downtick of two-tenths. Doesn't mean anything. Sometimes it indicates something. So we don't know. One obvious explanation is this. When you break out the U.S. birth rate ethnically, the Anglo birth rate is 1.8. The Hispanic birth rate in the U.S. is 3.2. That may be why we're hitting the 2.1. Remember I said there's a correlation between faith and kids? You can really see it playing out. If you take the famous red-blue political map, red is Republican, blue is Democrat, in the 2004 elections, I've not seen the numbers for the 2008 election. In the 2004 election, in states that voted for George W. Bush, the birth rate was 12% higher than in states that voted for John Kerry. It's a gigantic difference. You can even see it at the local level. If you take two American cities of approximately the same size and economic prosperity, Seattle and Salt Lake City, in ultra-liberal Seattle, not far from where I live, dogs now outnumber children by 45%. They're closing schools. It gets real nasty when you close schools. In Salt Lake City, kids outnumber dogs by 19%. They're building schools. Everywhere you look, you see this. By the way, when you're in that television talking head business, yeah, you meet the other talking heads. I mean, on camera, in the makeup rooms, hanging around, having coffee afterwards. Have you noticed when you watch all these talk shows, particularly on Fox, we have what appears to be an inexhaustible supply of blonde political strategists. I'm unable to figure out what they do with the rest of the day. They're all blonde, and they all have teeth like chiclets. Off camera, when you're talking to the blonde political strategists with teeth like chiclets who are Democrats, they're worried. The base is dying in cities like Buffalo, Cleveland, Pittsburgh. Populations aging and shrinking, just like in Europe. Off camera, the blonde political strategists with teeth like chiclets who are Republicans are actually very optimistic. That's where the high birth rates are. That's where the four-bedroom houses are being built. That's where Home Depot, Best Buy, Barnes & Noble are going in, where the churches and synagogues are being built, where the tax revenues are flowing. And when the 2010 census comes out, that's where the new congressional districts are. Did you notice about 6 weeks ago, in the middle of what we keep hearing is the worst economic crisis since human beings stood upright and stopped dragging their knuckles, the White House announced that they were shifting the Census Bureau from the Commerce Department into the White House? And everyone went, what? That's why. These demographic shifts are so powerful that you could flip to a Republican Congress in 2010 when the census comes out. Now, the implications for business on this are every bit as powerful as they are for politics. Business is real simple. You need customers. Your customers in this country will be in the red states and in the red counties of the blue states like New York and California. When you look around the world, world populations continuing to increase. That's because the Muslim countries still have very high birth rates. They go from about 2.4 to 6.8. They vary widely. In fact, there's an expression in that part of the world, you can beat us on the battlefield, we beat you in the bedroom. What they mean is in the long run, demographics wins, and indeed it does. By the way, every statistic I've given you on demographics is an official statistic. These are all World Health Organization government numbers. I didn't make up any of them. There is no alternate set of statistics. Everyone agrees on the numbers. You can disagree over what it means, but everyone's using the same numbers. They haven't changed much in 30 years. If we got up from here, went to every high school and college we can get to between now and the end of the day, how many instructors do you think will find teaching that all through the West birth rates are imploding? Not many. They're teaching the opposite. And that's wrong, and everybody knows it's wrong because the numbers haven't changed in 30 years. That's ideology infecting education. What they teach in the schools here, where I live, Europe, Japan, is that the worst thing that ever happened to planet Earth is humanity. We pollute, we use resources. You teach that to kids for 15 years, they grow up, they think bringing a baby into the world is committing a hostile act against the planet. Surprise! Birth rates are dropping. They're dropping so fast that even with the Muslim high birth rates, world population is now topping out and about to go down. According to the United Nations, we cross the line in 2045. Here's what happens. Because the birth rates are so low and we're living longer, for the first time in recorded history, the human population's getting older. In Japan, it's aging catastrophically. In England, by 2032, one out of four British citizens will be over the age of 65. How the other three are going to support them, no one knows. According to the United Nations, in 2045, for the first time in recorded history, the number of humans over the age of 55 will be larger than the number of humans under the age of 15. That's a completely different world. And the economic and political implications of that are staggering. You know, it's funny, we never shut up about being a youth culture. But for the first time, the human population's aging. So the numbers are actually the opposite of what everybody thinks they are. And there's a complete disconnect between what people think is happening and, in fact, what's happening. I'll come back again to that in a minute. One more point. There's something else happening out there which I think may be the most important one of all. Just stand back from all this politics, get yourself up to an altitude of about 90,000 feet, looking back on the Earth, sort of in the space shuttle, looking out the window. The picture changes. Today, more human beings are emerging from poverty more swiftly than at any time in history. By 1980 or thereabouts, about 2 billion human beings had emerged from poverty. Since then, another 500 million have emerged from poverty, mostly in India and China. And as they come out of poverty, they're pulling people out of poverty all over the world because of their demand for raw materials, goods, and services. Latin America is politically volatile, but economically it's growing at an annual rate of over 4%. That's very good. Africa has its disasters, Rwanda, Darfur. But today on the African continent, there are now 17 countries whose annual economic growth rates consistently exceed 4%. It's fabulous. Put all the numbers together, here's what you've got. Each year, year in, year out, between 50 million and 100 million human beings have emerged from poverty. The low estimate's 50, the high estimate's 100, somewhere in between. Probably slowing down a little bit now because of the recession. If we can sustain that pace, or anything even remotely like it, here's what it means. Within our lifetimes, or certainly within our children's lifetimes, the majority of human beings will be middle class. That's the biggest change of life on Earth that's ever happened, and it's the biggest underreported story in the world. It's happening because, in effect, we figured it out. There are some things that over time just become part of the human consciousness. You don't learn them in a class. Everybody knows it. Simple example, physical fitness. You want to be physically fit, eat sensibly, get a lot of exercise. You don't need a PhD from Harvard to know that. Everybody knows that. So one way to do it, but everybody knows, eat sensibly, get exercise, you can be fit. Well, everybody knows that more and more people do it. You see people jogging all hours of the day and night. People like us join health clubs. We try and eat more sensibly. Well, on a much larger scale, if you want to bring people out of poverty massively, the combination is entrepreneurship, free enterprise, the rule of law, property rights, competent regulation, moderate taxes. You put all that in place, and boom, people come out of poverty. By the way, everybody knows it. Every peasant in every field has figured that out. What they know, they can't put those words on it. What they know is that if the government will protect them rather than threaten them, give them a framework, rule of law, regulation, they can work in, tax them at a reasonable amount, and then get out of the way. Do things the government's supposed to do. Build roads, operate the schools, pick up the garbage, deliver the mail. They can figure out how to feed their family. Maybe even start a business and hire somebody. Everybody knows that. Well, over the last couple of decades, more and more countries have been putting in place the free market mechanisms to pull their people out of poverty. And the result is simply staggering. What you're seeing out there is the greatest burst of industrialization ever as India, China, and all these other countries put in place the mechanisms to create a middle-class society. As a practical matter, you cannot bring 2, 3, 4, 5 billion people out of poverty with everybody designing software. The world doesn't work like that. You need stuff. You need roads, schools, hospitals, houses, whole new cities, shopping centers, malls, everything. That's what's driven up energy prices. Energy is to a modern economy what blood is to a body. A child's body has 3 to 4 quarts of blood. An adult's body is bigger. It has 5 to 6 quarts of blood. As the world economy has grown, and over the last couple of decades, it's grown as it's never grown before, that's what drove energy prices up. You can no sooner tell a growing economy to use less energy than you can tell your teenager to eat less food. Body's growing. It needs it. There's a complete disconnect. Everyone thinks that energy prices went up because fat cats were jumping in their SUVs and driving to the country club. No. Energy prices went up because we're creating a global middle class, and that's extraordinary. It needs energy. It also needs protein, and that's what's driven up food prices. You know, all through history, year in, year out, very quietly, without getting on CNN, hundreds of millions of people die each year of starvation. It's terrible. Now you see people in other countries protesting food prices are up, and that is a real problem. For the first time, they're buying food. Now that's sent the prices up. That's a problem. We'll have to deal with that. But you didn't see that before because they used to just die of starvation. Now they're in the middle class. This emergence of a global middle class is the biggest thing happening in the entire world. It's good for several reasons. First, there's a lot of kids not hungry. Wonderful to see people come out of poverty. Second reason it's good, it's a very practical one. It's our market. These people will need every product and service we Americans can provide for them. They're going to need the energy. They're going to need the protein. They want the iPods, they want the washing machines, they want everything we can possibly provide. That is how we can get this economy out of a ditch. What it means, to be precise, is that the market, the customer base for every product and service you can provide is growing at a rate of 50 to 100 million new customers a year. That's extraordinary. It's one final reason it's good. We middle-class societies are boring. All we want to do is drop the kids off at school, do a day's work, come home, see if they pass their math test, see if Netflix delivered whatever movie you want waiting for, get together with some friends, watch a ball game, go out to dinner, just live. The last thing a middle-class society wants is a war. Messes up everything. And you're heading into a world in which the majority of human beings will be middle-class. Boy, is that a big change. When I was in college, we studied something called the third world. Remember that? It was a polite way of saying losers. By the way, there was no second world. It was the first world and the third world. You never find out what the second world was. Most of the countries in the third world are now developing countries. The last big chunk that hasn't made it into modernity is that Muslim part of the world that's giving us all the trouble. And if we can get them over the line and into the modern world, then the majority of human beings are middle class. And that is the biggest thing happening in the world. Now, let's take a fast loop back and see where we are on all this. The war. In some ways, the war is going extraordinarily well. In Iraq, we've just about won it. Now, whether you think we should have gone in there in the first place or not, that decision was made years ago. We went in. Have we made mistakes? Sure. I'm simply reporting to you that we've just about got it won. And the definition of won is Iraq is a functioning democracy not threatening its neighbors. That makes it the second one in the Mideast. The other's Israel. That's an unbelievable accomplishment. Almost there, but not quite. You ever see a racehorse stumble 10 yards before the finish line? Doesn't happen often, but it could happen. Something ghastly could happen in Iraq tomorrow. A political assassination, a bombing, the whole thing blows apart. Probably won't happen. That horse will probably get over the finish line. but it's possible. You know, until it's over, it ain't over. But that's going really, really well. Really is. We paid a very high price, but really done it. Probably the best thing in the entire war is that for the first time, there is now a global reform Muslim movement. Men and women, professionals like yourselves, religious leaders, scholars, intellectuals, they're talking about how to reconcile that operating system with the modern world. This is the conversation in the Mideast. At luncheons like this, at Kiwanis Club meetings, on talk shows, on the radio, internet chat rooms, at the universities, the whole question is how do we reconcile our faith with the modern world? That's an extraordinary development, and it didn't happen before the war started. It couldn't have happened. These people couldn't have communicated with each other. They couldn't travel. They got killed if they tried. And now you can't shut them up. That in the Mideast, people like us talk about how do we reconcile this operating system with the modern world. I'll give you one example. When the Pope gave that speech in Regensburg, if you remember, everybody came down on the poor guy. Said 81-year-old German Rottweiler doesn't know what he's doing. Boy, did he know what he was doing. When the fuss died down and no one was looking anymore, 138 Islamic religious leaders got together and wrote an open letter to the Vatican saying, okay, let's talk. Wow. That conversation between the Vatican and Islam opened in Rome on November 4, 2008. By sheer coincidence, our election day, which is why you didn't know that. My guess is if anybody remembers October 4, 2008, 1,000 years from now, it may well be because that's the date the conversation opened in Rome between the Vatican and Islam. It's an extraordinary development. You know, we look for world leaders. Listen, this guy's one of them. He's engaging our adversaries at an intellectual level none of us could touch. And I imagine his day job keeps him busy. To jump in on this, the way he's done it, at the level he's doing it, is an extraordinary act of statesmanship. And by the way, a very hopeful sign for the future, because that's the conversation. Remember, that's what we wanted to happen. So a lot of good stuff happening. Unfortunately, there's a lot of bad stuff happening. Afghanistan, the Taliban is back. We're having to send in a lot more troops. Pakistan's coming unglued, and unglued really fast. And then there's Iran. Now, look, this is the classic case of nuts with nukes. You know, this is a bunch of us standing outside our kids' school at 5 to 3. We're chatting, waiting to pick them up. And while we're chatting, we see a visibly deranged man running toward the schoolyard saying, I'm holding a hand grenade. I love death. I hate kids. Great. What do you want to do? We can keep chatting. Maybe it's a bad joke. Maybe it's a nice guy who's off his meds. But, you know, if he's some nut and that really is a hand grenade, while we're chatting, he's closing the gap. And if he gets close enough and throws the grenade, it's a mess. The problem with Iran is that Ahmadinejad and the mullahs, the people who run it, are out of their minds and they're building nuclear bombs. The definition of out of your mind is they're talking about building nuclear bombs and using them, trading their cities and populations for ours, and that puts you in the nut category. You know, in the Cold War, we used to say the Russians are bastards, but they're not crazy bastards. They didn't want to lose Moscow. We could talk to them. It's unpleasant, but we could talk to them. These guys are talking about giving up their cities and populations for ours. That makes you crazy. Listen, I ran the national estimates. I used to do this for a living. I'll give you a professional opinion. Iran will have a nuclear bomb sooner than anybody expects. And that's the easiest prediction to make because that's what always happens. I hate to tell you this, it's not that hard. We invented the nuclear bomb. That was the Manhattan Project, World War II. The total elapsed time from launching the Manhattan Project to Hiroshima was 4.5 years. That's all it was. That was the 1940s. You don't have to invent the bomb now. You download the plans. You can buy virtually every part you want on the open market or the black market. The only tricky part's the fuel, the highly enriched uranium into the plutonium. It's not that hard. If you have the money, you can buy the talent. Iran has both. My guess is they've done it, that they're either finished the cycle or they're awfully close, and next Thursday, 14 months from now, 6 months from now, they announce they got the bomb. And then it's a mess. It's an absolute complete mess. Then the question is, what do you want to do about it? You've only got two choices. Take out the nuclear facilities or take out the regime. I don't know what's going to happen next, but I'll tell you, the great lesson of the 20th century is crazy people get power. Hitler was crazy, brilliant, cunning, crazy. So was Stalin. Idi Amin was a nutcase. The maniacs who killed 2.5 million people in Cambodia, they're crazy. Crazy people get power. And when crazy people tell you what they're going to do, believe it. That's the lesson of the 20th century. And of all people in the world, the Israelis learned that lesson. You know, there were Jews in Germany in 1938. They hadn't gotten out. They owned businesses. They came to luncheons like this. They had season tickets to the Berlin Philharmonic. And they watched the Nazis take power. And they said, listen, this is really a mess. But I mean, come on. What are they going to do? Kill us all? As a matter of fact, yeah, it's exactly what they did. The Israelis hadn't forgotten that. My guess, Keith and I were chatting about this yesterday, if anything wakes up the president in the middle of the night in the next few weeks, it's Iran. That the Israelis have launched or about to launch or want to launch or tried launching and something went wrong. This is coming to a head. So you've got Pakistan unglued, Afghanistan's kind of sloppy, and Iran's coming to a head really fast because the clock's running out on that. The point is this. This is the equivalent of 1943. We're in the middle of a war. Now, I'm not sure the president gets this. He's a wartime president. He doesn't want to be a wartime president. He's a wartime president. And wars have a funny habit of blowing right up on you just when you think everything's under control. So fasten your seatbelts. We're in the middle of a war, and it's going to get real nasty over the next few weeks and few months. On to the demographics. I hate to tell you this, Europe is dying. Now, obviously, you can reverse low birth rates, but not quickly. That's biology. A legislature can change the tax rate overnight. You can't change the birth rate overnight. The European birth rates are now so low that to get back to the 2.1 replacement level will take two generations. You need a bigger generation to have a bigger generation. That's 40 to 50 years. They haven't started. So if the headline on the news tonight is European birth rates leap, and it won't be, but if it is, they've started a 40 to 50 year clock. I don't know any economic model that says you got 40 to 50 years. Some countries don't even get it. In England, about 3 months ago, the Journal of the British Medical Association, it's the magazine that goes to every practicing physician in the country, ran an editorial urging doctors to discourage their women patients from having children because of carbon footprint. In Spain, where they're in a demographic death spiral, they've passed a law. It is now illegal in Spain to use the words mother and father on a birth certificate. They're sexist. The official words on a Spanish birth certificate are progenitor A and progenitor B. Don't laugh, you're being culturally insensitive, which may be a crime. That ain't going to help the problem. My favorite example, we were talking about this morning, is Russia. Listen, Putin's driving Russia into the same ditch the communists drove it into in the 20th century. That's another conversation for another day. They do understand the demographics. The birth rate in Russia is so low, the average lifespan of a Russian man is now under 58 years of age. The birth rate is so low that by 2050, the population of Russia will be smaller than the population of Yemen, which is a high birth rate. Yemen's a little place. Russia's huge, covers nearly one-sixth of the Earth's land surface. There's no way to keep that economy going or even to defend its borders with the population dropping that fast. So what do they do? The governor of the province of Ulyanovsk issued a proclamation. From now on, September 12th of every year is officially the day of conception. Under the terms of the proclamation on September 12th, all workers are given the afternoon off with orders to... This used to happen to me at the White House. I'm just telling you, don't laugh at me. With orders to go home and create a patriot for Russia. Only in Russia do they order this. By the way, the nothing burger who's president of Russia, Medvedev, thinks, great idea. So next year, they're going to expand this from Ulyanovsk to the whole country next September 12th. Somebody must have gotten to Medvedev and said, listen, you can't call it the Day of Conception. So they had to come up with a new name. You know, Russian PR is like not great. The official name for it is the Day of Marital Contact. Here are the numbers. 2.1 is the replacement level on birth rates. Demographers tell us 1.3 is the suicide rate, the rate from which a society cannot recover its population. Today, on the European continent, there are 17 countries whose birth rates are at or below 1.3. And so is Japan. There are your numbers. In Canada, they have a 1.5 birth rate. They deal with it through immigration. In the last 20 years, most of the immigrants to Canada have been ethnic Chinese. Canada says in the next 20 years, most will come from the Indian subcontinent. Here's what will happen in the U.S. Unless something changes radically, and I don't think it will, in the next 25 to 30 years, we're going to bring between 60 and 70 million immigrants into the United States. That's the number we need to keep the machine going. That's why that number keeps coming up. Obviously, they'll be mostly but not entirely Hispanic. By the way, despite the economic downturn and the housing problems, today in the United States we have fewer than half the buildings we will need to support a 25% increase in our population. Buildings for people to live in, work in, play in. So once we pull out of this ditch, we're in the early stages of a $30 trillion construction boom just to accommodate a 25% increase in our population. So those are the numbers you're working with. On to this last point, this extraordinary explosion of wealth around the world. In my judgment, this is the biggest thing happening. You have the emergence of a global middle class, and that's great, but there's a problem. If we bring 2, 3, 4, 5 billion people out of poverty, and the air is polluted, we can't breathe it, and the water is polluted, we can't drink it, it's a disaster. On the other hand, the one thing we can never say to these people is, no, sorry, too late, I've got a big house and 2 SUVs, you can't. That's inhuman. The fortunes will be made by those businesses that can develop products that are clever, inexpensive, and green. And that's why you're hearing that. This is no longer an environmental issue. This is now the core driving issue of global business. We want to bring all these people out of poverty and do it without trashing the planet. That's an interesting problem to have. It's not a government program. It's a million different things. You may have read that the Tata Automobile Group just launched the Nano, the $2,500 car for the emerging middle class. Clever, inexpensive, green. Do you know IKEA, the Swedish furniture stores? You ever see the IKEA house? They don't market it in North America. It's about 900 square feet. Looks exactly the way you think an IKEA house would look. You can't quite put it on top of your car and drive it home. But it's neat. It's stylish. You screw it together on a slab, probably with the same stupid little black wrench you use for everything else. Made out of materials that don't rot in a hot climate. You want to bring people out of poverty? That's brilliant. Everywhere you look, you're seeing clever, inexpensive green. You want to buy one of my books? Good. Go over to Barnes & Noble, buy the book. I'll cut down a tree to make the book, and then I'll burn fuel shipping it to you. Or you can download the ebook version. No environmental damage. Same product, fraction of the cost. Whoever invented ebooks was thinking clever, inexpensive, green. That's where the future is going to be in business. So when you look at this market that's growing at a rate of 50 to 100 million customers a year, and you want to be part of that, clever, inexpensive, green. It's not an environmental issue anymore. And when I get to talk to young people, thanks to Lisa, I got to talk to some high school kids this morning, but we didn't get into this. And they always look at this, well, how are we going to do that? I don't know. That's why we're sending you to college. This is an interesting problem. Bring the world out of poverty and don't trash the planet. That's kind of fun. That's a nice problem to have. The two countries, and by the way, we're going to need energy. We're going to need more energy than you can imagine to create a global middle class. Whether it's oil, nuclear, biofuels, wind, solar, probably all of the above and a couple of things we haven't thought about. boy, is the market for energy going to explode, and also the market for protein. In the last 8 years, meat consumption in China has more than doubled. It's a lot of cows and pigs. What do they eat? Corn. That's what's driving up the prices. The two countries leading the way are India and China. Things are changing very fast in both countries. China is in terrible, terrible trouble. Despite all the progress they've made a lot, it's still a bunch of commies running the place. That's not the kind of government that's going to make it in the 21st century. They shoot dissidents. They build schools out of unreinforced concrete. With an earthquake, all the schools collapse. They cheat! Please don't tell me all the girls on the Olympic gymnastics team were 15. They weren't, okay? If you're going to cheat on something like that, you're going to cheat on arms control, trade, everything else. That government has just got to get its act together. There's a more serious problem. China now has a critical shortage of professional management talent. They're short by millions of professional managers. They're perfectly aware of it. They're scrambling to fix it. They're setting up all kinds of training programs with a lot of American universities. They can't get in front of it. It's happening too fast. And this critical shortage of professional managers is slowing down their projects, getting things off track. It's a real problem. It's the third one that ends it. You know, China has the one child per family policy. Birth rate's 1.1. China is now the most rapidly aging country in the world. Japan had the very good sense to get rich before it got old. China's doing it the other way around. They can't make it. Even at their economic level, the cost of caring for that massive aging population is going to finish them off. They just can't do it. By the way, do the math. Over the next 35 to 40 years, the Chinese population will drop about 35%. That's biology, not politics. That's a done deal. Population's about to go straight off a cliff. It's the most rapidly aging country in the world. Keep your eye on India. India's coming up fast on the outside. By the way, the birth rate's 2.8. Speaks English, has the rule of law. It's a democracy. In the last few years, India has made one of the most important decisions in modern history. For 50 years, all India wanted was to lead the third world. Drove everybody nuts. What India now says is, we've outgrown that. Now we want to sit at the head table with the big boys. Good for India. They belong at the head table with the big boys. India's decision to come over to the head table is one of the most important decisions of our lives. By the way, Putin, the idiot, had a seat at the head table. Got up and now he's sitting by himself in the corner. That'll go down as one of the dumbest decisions of modern history. India's playing with the big boys. My guess is that India will blow past China. As China's problems mount, and they can't get past the demographics, because you can't change that fast, I think India's going to blow past them. They're starting to build the kind of infrastructure China's been building. As China stumbles in manufacturing, India's moving into manufacturing. You can think of China as the world's manufacturing, India as the world's service and software center. That's a kind of a neat distinction. Do business with both. It's not an either or. You don't have to choose. But don't not notice India is really, really moving. And in my judgment, India will surpass China. There's one interesting thing happening in both countries. We talked about this morning at that high school. It almost never gets talked about. I'll just take a minute and tell you about this. It's back to the demographics. A short lesson in biology. When we have children, you get 103 boys for every 100 girls. That's the human ratio. It's not Republican versus Democrat or American versus Oriental. The human ratio is 103 boys for every 100 girls. In India, today, almost anywhere in the world, expectant parents know the sex of an unborn child, unless they say they don't want to be told. In India and China, there's a cultural preference for boys, so they've been aborting the girls. So many that in India and China, instead of having the normal human ratio of 103 boys for every 100 girls, the ratios in India and China are now 118 boys for every 100 girls. In some provinces, the ratios now exceed 130 boys for every 100 girls. What this means in real numbers is that today, right now, there are more than 100 million boys growing up in these two countries who will never find wives. That's unprecedented in world history. Let me tell you, the single most destabilizing force in the world is a bunch of unmarried men. India and China are in panic mode. It is now a crime in both countries to disclose the sex of an unborn child. I mean, that's how far that's gone now. In China, the Chinese government says by 2050, the gender gap will exceed 200 million. The thought of 200 million single guys hitting Shanghai and Beijing on Friday night is a political nightmare, okay? There are now businesses in China. Their business is to fly Chinese bachelors to Vietnam for wives. They load up the 747s on Friday night, fly them over to Saigon, sorry, Ho Chi Minh City, and they've arranged receptions at hotels like this where they meet the Vietnamese girls, and they're sweeping across Vietnam into Laos and Cambodia and bringing back huge numbers of wives. You can imagine the mess this is causing in countries like Laos and Cambodia where it's happening. In India, they have the same problem. Wife shortage? So there's a new business in India now. It's an industry, not just a business. If you're one of the Indian men lucky enough to have a wife, you can now rent her to someone who doesn't. Don't look at me like that. I didn't set this up. On average, it's a 3-month rental at $175 a month. The reason I'm telling you this, with our economic problems, you're getting a lot of people saying we're not just in trouble, that the whole American model is no longer workable, and that we have to look to countries like India and China for the model of the 21st century. Yet not so fast. So you're hearing a lot about our model is finished. It's imperfect, and we need to make changes, but I'm not so sure someone else has a better model. Now, look, in the last few minutes here, we've made about 14 orbits around the planet. And you've been very patient, and thank you for giving me the time. I wanted to cover a lot of territory. Here's what you do with all this. Think about it. We have a right to expect the people we elect to understand this stuff. Now, we can argue over what to do about it. That's a good political argument. We have a right to expect them to understand this and have some sense of where they want the United States to be, how they want us to fit into this. Honorable people can disagree, but we have to understand before we know what we're disagreeing about. And that's the conversation that needs to get going. What's happening out there? What does it mean to us? And then we can argue over, and what do you want to do about it? And we don't have those kinds of conversations. We just yell and scream at each other. Now, some of this stuff's a little bit scary, and it can kind of be off-putting. I understand that. My advice to you is this. Be an optimist. One thing we all learned when we worked for President Reagan, be an optimist. The optimists solve the problems. The pessimists can describe a problem. They can't solve it. The optimists are the ones who come up with the solutions. I get to travel around the country a lot. I get to meet a lot of people like yourself. The thing that is most encouraging is it's America. We're optimists. So my advice to you is be an optimist. I'm one. I hope you will be too. Thank you.
You've been listening to Herb Meyer, author, producer, and former senior intelligence official for President Reagan. He was recorded in Anchorage speaking at the Alaska World Affairs Council on May 1st, 2009. Following his talk entitled, What in the World is Going On?, an intelligence briefing for Alaskan leaders, Mr. Meyer responded to questions from the audience. First, he was asked, how do you reconcile your apparent bottom line in light of the Anchorage Declaration passed last month following the Indigenous Peoples Global Summit on Climate Change?
I don't know the answer to your question. But by the way, and I mean it quite seriously, there isn't a single one of you in this room who knows what I think we should do about this. I left my politics out of this. This was an intelligence briefing. I'm describing what's going on. What you wish to do about it is another issue. So if those people who produced that document, what facts are they using? I'm just giving you a bunch of facts. Again, I didn't make them up, okay? People have to decide this. You have to reconcile these things. I can't do that for you. I understand what you're asking. Remember, I didn't have a point of view here. This is what's going on out there. The question is, what do you wish to do about it? You have to decide. Let's cut through all the crap. Are you concerned that the planet Earth is warming and that changes everything? Okay. By the way, I'm not a scientist, okay? I just don't. I follow this. I'm not a scientist. What I can understand is this. I've asked the climate people two questions for which I cannot get an answer. What we know is that back in the 10th and 11th centuries, the temperature of our planet was 4 degrees Celsius warmer than it is now. This is called the medieval climate optimum. Note the word optimum. I didn't make it up. That's what they call it. So why was it warmer? There was not enough human activity to do that. I don't know what the answer is, but they won't answer my question. They've also told us that Mars is warming. So are Martians whizzing around in SUVs up there? I don't know. I can't get an answer to my question. Something's not right here. I come from an intelligence background. Answer my question, guys. So I don't know. That's where we are on that.
Lacking the separation of church and state, you seem to provide a somewhat negative description of Islam, another audience member stated. Standing as the combination of religion and governance, can you compare Islam fundamentalism with Christian fundamentalism and its unwillingness to accept modern-day science?
Good question. Look, you're going to get people on both ends of the spectrum, on this extreme end and that extreme end. They're going to drive everybody crazy. So you do get that. You can have Islamic fundamentalists. You can have Christian fundamentalists. There are right-wing Republicans who can drive everybody crazy, left-wing Democrats who can drive everybody. You do get that. That's part of human nature. If they're the extremes and sort of contained, it's not a problem. We live with it. We live with it. Over the centuries, in the West, we separated church and state. Remember, we used to have the Holy Roman Empire. It was one thing. And then it got separated. So we've learned to do that. We've made that kind of progress. Is it perfect? No. That part of the world, the part of the world I was describing, hasn't really made that separation yet. They're beginning to in some places, and that's a good thing. So you sort of have to eliminate the extremes on both ends, and then you can deal with what's in the middle. And that's kind of how you have to get at that. And if you can just contain the extremes, it's all right. So you can be an extreme over there. This one's an extreme over there. The rest of us are going about our business. And that's really where you have to go. And can you get that majority in the middle to say, hey, listen, knock it off. So you get it in both. Now, as a practical matter, Islam has been in the middle of a civil war since the 7th century. In shorthand, the moderates versus the radicals. It's always a good idea to stay out of somebody else's civil war. It's like staying out of somebody else's marriage problems. Don't jump in. They will not be grateful to you. This is a case where their civil war hit us, spilled over and hit us. So we have to deal with it. Now, again, we can disagree over how to deal with it, but what you're really looking at is this centuries-old civil war within Islam that every so often spills out and hits Western civilization. And so we've got to kind of deal with it in one form or another, and that's really what you're seeing now. This is the third time their civil war has spilled over and hit us. But now you're living in an age when a small number of people can kill a large number of people quickly, and that makes it different.
I have trouble with your characterization of Iraq today, saying the past is the past, another audience member stated. What are your sources in saying Iran is so close to having nuclear weapons when the IAEA has not found any evidence of that? And why should we trust that Iran has nuclear weapons or is currently developing them this time around?
Fair enough. Because they say so. One thing I've learned is take their word for it. Take their word for it. They tell us they're building them, so they tell us they're building it. I assume they are. If they're faking it, don't fake it. You know, it's foolish to come at me and say, I've got a gun and I'm going to pull the trigger. I'm going to react to it. Now, look, we did make a mess of it in the weapons of mass destruction thing in Iraq. I quite agree with you on that. But the Iranians tell us they're doing this. Now, again, in my experience in dealing with this stuff, once you set out to do it, you can do it. It's not all that hard. So I assume they'll do it. And they say that they will use them. So I'm taking their word for it. And as a practical matter, if somebody says I'm building nuclear bombs and I plan to use them, I'll take their word for it. And by the way, that was Saddam Hussein's problem. He said he was doing it. If he wasn't doing it, he should have said so. Now, having said that, yeah, the Bush administration made a complete mess of it. Look, I'll tell you an interesting story about that. Remember, I ran the estimates. If you go back to the 1980s, remember we had all that trouble in Central America? Sandinistas and all that, remember that stuff? And Reagan used to go around saying that the Russians are trying to destabilize Central America. It's going to be a mess. And everyone would say, oh, he's an amiable idiot. There he goes again. We had it. What we had were satellite photographs of weapons being loaded onto Soviet ships. The ships at sea, docking at the port of Managua, Nicaragua, the weapons being offloaded, put on trucks, and hidden in the garage behind the residence of the Soviet ambassador. We really had it. And when some senator or congressman would go say, oh, Reagan doesn't know what he's talking about, we'd show him this stuff. And he'd say, oh, my God. Now, look, guys, you got to stop this. By the way, half the time, then he'd go out to the television cameras and lie. Okay? Anyway, he said, when President Bush started talking about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, I turned to my wife and said, I guess we got it. And we didn't. We didn't. What didn't happen somewhere in the national security mechanism is somebody didn't tie George Tenet to a seat. Tenet was the CIA director then. And say, hey, George, where are the weapons? Now, if Tenet could say, there, that building right there just south of Baghdad, all right, put a satellite over it, get a Delta team around it, so when we get there and blow in the doors, there are the weapons. But if Tenet said, well, I don't really know. I'm sure they're there. I just don't know where. Stop. And that's what didn't happen. So they made a mess of it. But that doesn't mean necessarily what they did was wrong. Now, you kind of put a lot of stuff in there. Is Iraq having problems at the moment? Yes. It's excruciating to watch on television. After the American Revolution, it took us 10 years to get a constitution. No one was shooting. So these things are tough. So we'll see. We'll have to see how that works out.
Lastly, another audience member who spent the last 8 years living in Kenya asked Mr. Meyer two questions. First, he asked, as we attempt to provide products for the growing middle class, where is the opportunity for the United States to compete with India and China?
The opportunity isn't precisely where you were shopping. You know, they got malls. There's a growing middle class. That's an opportunity for us if we're clever enough to grab it. Whether we are is another question, but that's an opportunity. We should be able to compete with other companies in other countries. If we can't, then we really are finished. So the opportunity is there. The question is whether we can grab it. What was your second question?
Secondly, he asked Mr. Meyer, while Europe may be dying, how do you feel about family planning in Africa?
Well, again, let me go back to what I said at the beginning. We argue before we understand. I don't know what Africa should do. That's their business, not mine. And I mean that very profoundly. This is the whole point. Let them figure it out. It's their business, not my business to figure it out. Now, I'm an American, so I've got my own views on what we ought to do in this country and all that. But that's, again, another conversation. The whole point is, if you can explain to people what's going on and what it means, then you can make intelligent decisions. Intelligence is to a government what radar is to the captain of a 747. It's the instrument that tells them what's going on out there before it would otherwise be visible. What you do about it is the captain's business. If you tell them there's a mountain out there, one pilot will go over it, another pilot will go around it. It's a management decision, if you will. The whole point of an intelligence briefing is to illuminate the future. And the whole point of using intelligence is if you can see the future soon enough and clearly enough, then you can change the future before it happens. And that's the whole point. And what I tried to do this afternoon is not tell you what I think we should do about the future, but try and illuminate the future just a little bit so that you can now go about the business of deciding what you would like that future to be. And perhaps I ought to stop there, and I know you've got very busy schedules this afternoon, so thank you for letting me take up so much of your time.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Herb Meyer, author, producer, and former senior intelligence official for President Reagan. He was recorded in Anchorage speaking at the Alaska World Affairs Council on May 1st, 2009. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.